It's now 8 o'clock. Could someone just push that door to? It makes it a little bit quieter. Nice to see everybody here. Thank you, Matt, for the slideshows. Matt has been doing some work on gathering obscure and scurrilous humanistic, atheistic and other sort of material for our delectation. So, welcome to the Sheffield Humanist Society. This evening we have Murshid Al-Farah from the Palestine Solidarity Campaign come to speak to us. Always try to put the put a talk into perspective. Palestine Solidarity Campaign campaigns for a secular state in Palestine, and that's in an area which has obviously been riven by all sorts of religious conflicts. Monsieur himself is he is a civil engineer, but in our context, he's a political and human rights campaigner around Palestine, Palestinian state, and also looking for the right to return for displaced Palestinians. The format for this evening is we will have a talk from Mushir for about 25 minutes, after which the floor will be open to everyone to discuss. We'll try to keep it in discussions, and I'll give a little bit more information when we start that, and then Mushir will have a chance to sum up afterwards. So, can I welcome Mushir?
Thank you very much.
And thank you.
Thanks. Thank you for inviting me. And this meeting comes by coincidence, only 2 days after the 93rd anniversary of the notorious Balfour Declaration. And that's when the Palestinian tragedy effectively started. That was the 2nd of November 1917, when the British government, through its Foreign Secretary, Lord James Arthur Balfour, issued the notoriously famous Balfour Declaration, in which the British government promised the establishment of a Jewish homeland in the land of Palestine. And they issued this very false statement that it's a land, people without land, for in land without people. People without land, in land without people, which means people without land, the Jews, in land without people, Palestine, which was a total lie. Now, before that, what led to the Balfour Declaration is really interesting. The Zionist movement held its first conference in Switzerland, in Basel, in 1897. And in that conference, they decided to establish a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. They were offered so many places. They were offered Uganda, Argentina, a place in Europe near Belgium, but they chose Palestine for reasons that nothing to do with the way they were thinking, because most of the leaders of the Zionist movement were secular, but they understood how important the religious factor for the Jewish people, so they used it as a vehicle to attract all support from all Jews all over the world. Now, between 1897 and 1917, pressure and lobbying within the British government, which, as I'm going to show in one of the slides, had influence in the area, was mounting until it reached the issuing of the Balfour Declaration. And to see how the map of the area has changed, I'd like to see it to start with the first slide. Yes, this slide shows the areas, the Palestinian areas and the Jewish areas in 1878. Again, this is taken from British Mandate days, documentation, United Nations, etc. And you can see all the red dots are the the Palestinian areas, and the very tiny small black dots are the Jewish ones, and these are mixed areas. Again, this is in 1920. You can see the Zionist towns, the Zionist colonies. I mean, we refer to them as Zionists because we don't like to use the term Jewish, because our enemies really are the Zionists, who used the Jewish people to create the state, which resulted in the destruction, actually, and demolition of the Palestinian heritage, culture, etc., livelihood. So you can see the ocean of areas that were Palestinian and the Zionist colonies, as they blue dots, which are very few. I'm sorry. It's, again, this is the major Arab towns. Again, the same story. You can see the major Arab towns are the red squares. The major Jewish settlements are the small dots, and other Jewish settlements as well. So the picture started to change slightly, but not.
We want to go up slightly the ceiling in this general direction still.
Sorry?
Can point it to the hip.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, this is, again, the notorious Sykes-Picot Agreement, 1916. Following the First World War, the area, the Arab world, was divided into areas of influence and areas of full control between the French and the British, which were the two main forces in the area. So you can see the blue zone, direct French control, that's Lebanon, parts of Syria, parts of Turkey and Iraq. French influence in this area, which is again Iraq and Syria. British influence in this area, which is Jordan, parts of Iraq, Gulf, and direct British control, Iraq and the Gulf area. Palestine came under the British mandate in 1916 after the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And that's where the ground was set for the Balfour Declaration to be issued. That's when the Zionist leaders were pressurizing government ministers within Britain, who are already pro-Zionist, to issue the Balfour Declaration. Again, that's another, I'm going to pass quickly, distribution of population of Palestine up to 1946, and that's very, very important, because this picture has altered completely. I mean, you can see the red areas and the blue areas. The blue areas are the Israeli, and the red areas are the Palestinians. You can see what happened. Again, the same thing, land ownership, 1945. I'll keep talking about 1945 because 1948, when the catastrophe happened. So that was the picture before 1948. Again, Palestinian red, Zionist blue and white in public and others. So you can see the difference. Now, with the issuing of the Balfour Declaration, the Zionist agencies all over the world started to organize waves and waves and waves of immigrations to Palestine. And that's when the trouble really started. Because before 1917, before the 2nd of 1917, Palestinians and Jews lived for thousands of years on the land, what was left of the Jewish people, without any trouble. There isn't in history any trouble between the Palestinians and the Jews in the land of Palestine before the 2nd of November. But then, with the waves and waves and waves of migrations coming to Palestine from all over the world, Germany, Poland, England, Britain, America, everywhere, and obviously taking over of land and whatever, the trouble started. So many skirmishes took place in the 20s, leading to the Peel Commission Partition Plan in 1937. And this is very, very, very important, because Lord Peel was a British diplomat, and he came out with this plan in 1937. In this plan, he proposed a Jewish state in this part and a Palestinian state in all this part, an area of Jerusalem to be under British mandate. The Peel Commission wasn't satisfied with the Zionists. Sorry, am I interrupting?
No, you're fine.
Sorry, I'm terrible with technology, that's why. So the Peel Commission was not satisfactory, so they moved it to the Woodhead Partition Plan. Again, area to remain under British mandate. They reduced the Palestinian areas and they increased the Jewish states. And then 1947 came, at the time, not now, the biggest disaster for the Palestinian people, because they simply, with all the slides I showed, with the distribution of population, with the Palestinians owning most of the land, with the Palestinians being the biggest majority of the land. They were given 44% of the land, and 56% was given to the Zionists. So the color in this blue is the Jewish state, and this one is the Palestinian state, and the international administrated Jerusalem was to be the case. Of course, at that time, Palestinians, Arabs in general, refused this partition plan because it was extremely unfair. And let me say something for history, that during that time, during this 30 years between the Balfour Declaration and 1947, the British Mandate authorities have clamped down any all Palestinian attempts to form resistance cells or to resist the taking over of their land, etc. Why? They turned their line down for the Zionist militias to be formed, the Ergon, the Shtem, the Haganah, etc., under the eyes and the nose of the British Mandate, until some of the Zionist groups like the Shtem felt they are so powerful that they started attacking the British troops in Palestine to force the British to leave Palestine. Now, I don't believe in this theory. I think it was cocked between the two. I think British authorities with the Zionists arranged this for the British government to have something in front of the population in Britain that we can't control it anymore, it's so chaotic, we're losing soldiers, etc. So they, in 1947, after the partition plan, Britain announced that it's ending its British mandate in Palestine, and in 1948, in May, the 1948 war took place. The story, the historical story, is that the Arabs, Palestinians, refused the partition plan, and Arab armies went into Palestine to kick the Jews out, promised the Palestinians, leave your homes for a month, we will just ethnically cleanse the Jews, then you can come back. Now, for years, for decades, we keep saying to the world, through many, many Palestinians and others, this is not true, until, fortunately enough, some brave Jewish historians, Israeli historians, came out and said that this was not the case. The ethnic cleansing plans were in motion months and months before the partition plan, and even the names of the villages, the names of the people in the villages, how many, the population of the villages, when to attack, how to attack, how to terrify. I personally have a personal experience because through my activism, we're making documentaries and films and books, etc. So I met so many of the elderly refugees who told me stories that made it clear to me that all this wasn't true. One of the stories, which I have it actually on film, and we're gonna have it in the film we are producing, Shevet Palestine Campaign, is about a father of a folk dancer who came with a group here called Mustafa. His father was 3 months old, and because of the severity of the Zionist attack, the family left. And after 4 hours of fleeing their home, they remembered that they left the baby in the house. Yeah. And this is on film. It's going to be part of the film which we are making. Hopefully, we'll launch it in April. So they came back after 4 hours. Other stories I filmed as well from tens of refugees about how they had to flee, how to sleep under trees to avoid the planes, because the Zionists had even planes when the Palestinians were hung high for having one bullet of an Ian Field gun, the famous gun. So that was when the Palestinian catastrophe happened, 1948. 418 villages and towns were wiped off the map completely. 820,000 Palestinians were made refugees in a matter of 1 week, leading to a month. So can you imagine 820,000 in 1948? Relatively speaking, when the tragedy happened in Sierra Leone in 1994, it broke our hearts, and it should do. When 500,000 went on the move, the whole world shook. But at the time, nobody knew about it, because there was a lot of collusion from so many big powers in the world. Now, the Rhodes Armistice Line, or a truce, followed the 1948 war. So the Zionists pushed and occupied all these areas to add to their state, which was in 1947. So the West Bank was created and the Gaza Strip. And they took all the area in the middle. So that's how the West Bank and the Gaza Strip came into existence. Well, they existed, but I mean in the current borders. The Gaza Strip came under the Egyptian administration. The West Bank came under the Jordanian administration. Again, that's just talking about which operations they carried out outside the UN proposed Jewish state, how they pushed. Again, that's land ownership of the land, as you can see before the 1947 partition plan. Again, how they moved all the Jewish only owned this land at 47. All the rest was by the Palestinians, but then they gave them all this land. That's the demilitarized zone again in Syria after the war. This is what happened with the population movement of the Palestinians after the 1948. The refugees lived in 418 villages all over Palestine here, from the north, Nazareth, Haifa, Akka, Yaffa. All these now have Jewish names: Asdod, Al Majdal. Hundreds of villages here and there, tens of villages. They moved mainly to Gaza, West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan. The biggest population went to Jordan and the Gaza Strip. And that's where a small, tiny area in the Gaza Strip, which is extremely small, 45 kilometers by 7 kilometers, have become the most heavily populated area over the decades, because two-thirds of the population, if not more, are refugees who came from all over Palestine after the catastrophe. And this is the Palestinian refugees, again all over the world. I mean, the Gaza Strip, 9 refugee camps. The West Bank, many but smaller. Jordan, refugee camps, all over the place. They've been living in these camps for 62 years now. And many, many of them still have the keys and the deeds to their houses. And what the world doesn't want to understand is that those people are not happy or are not willing to give up their right. Because this is, and we must remember, this is an individual right. I cannot talk on behalf of these people. You cannot talk. Palestinian government cannot talk. You are the only one who can give up the rights to you, the deeds to your house. You can give up this right, and if you don't give it, it will remain eternal for you, no matter how long, no matter how unpragmatic or unrealistic it is. But it's a just cause, which, as I said, it's the individual right, not us, not realism, not interest, not economical power, not military power. And fortunately, the Palestinians are still very resilient, and they bring in their kids generation after generation to say, "I'm not from Gaza." For instance, my friends from refugee camps in Gaza, they don't regard themselves from Gaza. They say, "I'm from Haifa, I'm from Yaffa, I'm from Asdod, I'm from Al Majdal, I'm from all these areas." And it's their right. It's their right. They were living a comfortable life. They were farming the land. They did nothing that deserved what happened to them. And yet, they are suffering this. And on top of this, to add insult to injury, in front of the world, they are the terrorists. They are the ones who are violent. They are the ones who are causing all troubles, and the culprits are the ones who are extremely, extremely respected, to the extent that the British Foreign Secretary is in Israel today to try to comfort them and say to them, "Don't worry, I promise you the fantastic law that allows you, me, and every British citizen the right to go to court and say, I want this war criminal put in jail for the war crimes." Now the British government, and to have to be honest, even the Labour government was trying before the coalition government to stop this law, to start a law that we cannot do that. Because this is, to be honest, this is our fight for justice. And I must say, with my head held high, this is something I'm so proud of, that all of us are working for. We cannot really bring those people to justice, but at least we make them scared to land in London or in Madrid, as what happened with Avi Dichter yesterday in Spain, because he was advised, "Don't come, because we cannot guarantee you'll be taken to jail." So yes, if you order the killing in cold blood of people who are waving white flags, you need to be brought to justice, like what happened in Gaza in the year 2009. Yes, if you destroy an environmental target for no reason, that's a war crime. If you collectively demolish houses, that's a war crime. If you imprison people collectively, like what's happening in Gaza, 1.5 million people, yes, it is a war crime. And there's no two ways about it. There's not. So if we can, if we cannot, like, physically bring these people to justice, this is a campaign which I'm personally very proud of, and I think people should be proud of being part of a campaign of bringing war criminals to justice. And these people, without any doubt, are war criminals. The same thing happened with the head of the Israeli Air Force in 2003 when he bombed a residential area to kill one leader of Hamas. He killed 16 civilians, within 9 of them were children. He arrived in Heathrow 3 years ago, but he was tipped from the Foreign Office, don't land, because there is an order for his arrest. What's happening now, we move from history, obviously, to 1967. We'll just finish with the part of history, with the contemporary history. This is after the 1967 war. The Israelis controlled the whole land of Palestine, the entire Sinai Desert, the Golan Heights, part of Lebanon, and little part of Jordan as well. So they completed their occupation of Palestine. This is the occupied part of the Golan Heights. After, obviously, in 1994, the Palestinians signed a peace treaty, the PLO signed a peace treaty with Israel called the Oslo Accord, which was extremely poor on the Palestinian behalf. To start with, the Palestinians recognized the right of Israel to live in Palestine. The Israelis only recognized the PLO, but they didn't recognize explicitly what the Palestinians recognized, which was a very poor-ish thing. The Oslo Accord just changed the West Bank to areas of Palestinian populated areas severed by Israeli military installations and settlements. The Oslo Accord didn't stop the real main issue of now, the colonialist Israeli nature, which is settlements. The Oslo Accord didn't solve the problem of travel for Palestinians, freedom of travel. Then, obviously, in 2000, the Second Intifada broke out, and the Oslo Accord became history. In 2006, Hamas took over, 2007, Hamas took over control of the Gaza Strip, and ever since, the Gaza Strip has been under strict siege by the Israelis. But again, this is not the full truth. The fact that before that, about 7 years before that, the Gaza Strip was put under intermittent siege all the time. They opened for 3 weeks, they closed for 2 months. They opened for 6 weeks, they closed for 3 weeks. And so on and on. I mean, I personally went there once and I was stuck for 2 months because I couldn't come out. I went there, I couldn't even go from my town to visit my sister, who's about 4 kilometers from where I am. They put the Palestinians under a lot of pressure, leading to the full siege of the Gaza Strip, which is a massive, massive war crime by definition of international law, because if you imprison, and I think the word prison is the wrong word I'm using here, because, and people are hesitant to use the word prison camp, I would call it, or even concentration camp. Because a prison could imply that people inside the prison are guilty of some sort. But this is not. This is a 1.5 million concentration camp by guards, Israeli guards, Zionist guards all over. They are not allowing the Palestinians, even patients, to come out of the Gaza Strip. So far, 382 Palestinians died. People with cancer, people with renal failure, people with severe diseases, like serious diseases that cannot be treated in the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip hospitals are good for the fantastic doctors. They are really performing miracles there in terms of medicine. But they haven't got the equipment, the technology to deal with serious cases. They can't just prepare to go transfer to, but they are not. 382 have died. A lot of cases, kids who need just medicine. I have three distant cousins, sisters, who had this rare disease. And they needed tablets. And that was 2006. And one after the other died within 2 months. because they couldn't, their medicine wasn't there, and they couldn't leave to Egypt for treatment. How can this be accepted by the world? I don't understand. And yet we get voices that call for impartiality. We get the BBC, for instance, which is in the heart of the Gaza massacres, says we cannot air the emergency disaster appeal because we don't want the audience to lose faith in us and our impartiality. And I really want to bring to you this fantastic description by a famous journalist called Robert Fiske. He's very famous, and he said, if you are on a slave ship and you're talking to the slaves and the captain, you cannot be impartial. You have to be in favor of the slaves. If you are in a Jewish concentration camp, you cannot be impartial and thinking about the Nazi guard and the Jewish prisoners. The level of hypocrisy is untold. We hosted a very great man here called Professor Hayom Er, a Jewish survivor of Auschwitz. I don't know if some of you came to the meeting. He was here in February this year in the commemoration of Auschwitz. And the Queen refused to meet up with him. Not a single government minister met up with him because he's pro-Palestinian. And he's an Auschwitz survivor. When they liberated Auschwitz, he was there, ill and frail and everything. He was a young man. So the level of hypocrisy is unbelievable. Unbelievable, untoldable. And so the siege of Gaza is a disaster. The fishermen, thousands of them, who are very, very, very hardworking people and who fish to feed their families and survive, sell the rest of the fish. Again, they're stopped. And if they go to fish in areas where the fish is there, they allow them to fish in areas where there's no fish, in their own territorial water. If they go further, they're shot at. 14 of them were killed between the period, between the 2000 and 2008, and tens were injured. The farmers are not allowed to reach their farms in certain areas. Construction material, medicine, etc. Now, after what happened with the Mavi Marmara, the Turkish ship and their attack on it, they, to absorb public pressure in the Arab world, they opened the Gaza border just for the people who are going in. Like, I'm going the 11th of December. I will be allowed in, but coming out is a different story. I have to prove there's a reason for me to come out. My name will go, be scrutinized, be like, you know, does he deserve to go out, does he not? And that doesn't include patients. Patients are still dying. But if I have a work visa, yes, they will let me out, things like this. So it's not a full opening of the border. In the West Bank, the picture is similar with the building of the separation wall, well, inside the heart of the Palestinian areas, with attacks on farmers, etc. So what's the way out of this? What's the way out of it? In my view, with the current Israeli Zionist right-wing government, or any Zionist government for that matter, peace is surrender to the aggressors. It's as simple as that. The Palestinians, as the famous Jewish scholar Norman Finkelstein said, they will only accept you on your knees. And he said it openly. They will give peace to the Palestinians on their knees. I think the way forward is for the Palestinians to say, the armed struggle is there, but we will not practice it. It's there, it's the best, it's the holiest of our resistance, but we will not practice it. And for a long period of time, we start a popular movement of resistance to everything that is Zionist. And we get out of this peace process, which has given us nothing but settlements, nothing but suffering, nothing. The scale of suffering since the 1994, and I'm nearly 50 years old, and I've seen it before and after. We lived a better life under occupation. Our cause was alive, we were living, we were contiguous, and the world recognized us as people who didn't have control of their own land, and we continue to struggle for our land. Now, with this so-called peace process, they are reducing us, you know, they are treating us as subhumans. They are taking everything in the name of peace. Armed struggle is not the time for it now, I believe. But it's time to resist with every means necessary other than armed struggle, so that the world, which is changing directly, can be with us and we continue in our long term until until justice is prevailed for the Palestinians. And justice wouldn't be something that is the penis that's in front of the Palestinians. I'm saying it here in front of you. As a Palestinian, I will accept the historical compromise. In my view, every Israeli who came to Palestine after 1917 is a colonialist. The real Jews, who are the people, the real brothers of us, the Jewish brothers of us, are the ones who continue to live with the Palestinians. And all these colonialists have come after 1917. They are colonialists. But pragmatism, I will accept them. I will accept them in Palestine out of practice of realism and pragmatism, but not in a Zionist formula. I will accept in a new formula for all of us. And this is the challenge. This new formula is a land for all of us to live in it equally, to live it without like a lot of consideration to race, religion, etc. We all share the land, we all live together, and this is a compromise on the Palestinian side. And that's, I think, what should happen. But I keep emphasizing this is our compromise, because I don't believe any of these colonialists are, you know, there just because they belong there, or they came in peace, or they came to start business, or they're economic refugees, or whatever. No, they came by the power of gun. They killed us. They ethnically cleansed us. They kicked us out of our areas and lands. But I will accept them in a compromise if they don't accept the Zionist formula. And this is what the struggle will be. And this is, I think, what the struggle should be. Not this stupid peace process, which gave us nothing but suffering, gave away everything. Yes, to every kind of resistance against these people, until the world is building pressure on Israel. That's a long term, it wouldn't happen in my lifetime, but it's happening gradually. The signs are excellent. And the signs are good, gradually, slowly, but it is happening, and I think we should capitalize on this, and we should respond to this by saying no to this terrible peace process, and we continue with our struggle for freedom. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bashir. That was very interesting and very useful, I think, for many people.
Thank you.
Right, we will now throw the discussion open to the floor. What I will be doing is, if you want to make a point, please put your hand up. I will give you a nod to say that I've seen that you've made a point, and then, when it's your turn to speak, I'll indicate and ask you to speak, rather than having everyone trying to speak at once. If you do need to ask a question directly from Bashir, we might well sort of pile them up a little bit before they get answered. But really what we try to get everyone involved in the discussion as far as possible. So, Mike. Mike.
Oh, you're ready for me now?
Yes.
Can I ask for something, for clarification, which you can cover later? I lost track of some of the history around 1947 when you said that. I thought you'd said the Arab countries had come in and cleared the Palestinians, but I don't think that.
I didn't say that.
It was about who was it that came in and pushed the Palestinians into closer territory. Sorry, I was going to go on to a different question.
Yes, okay.
The thing that concerns us is the religious element in the area. We think it muddies the water. I remember when the states around, the Arab states around there, were Muslim in their population, but secular in their governing. And the early resistance movements were Palestine liberation, not holy war. And that then changed.
Mm-hmm.
Has that made it impossible to fix, really? The fact that there is this fanatical religious element, whereas previously it was essentially political and secular.
Mm-hmm. I'll take a couple of more points first. Barry?
Yeah. I'd like to say hello to Mushir.
Oh, hi.
We go back a few years, I think.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I would like to invite you to ensure that next May you're back in Chesterfield for the biggest and best May Day event in Britain.
I'll be honoured, yeah.
And you'll be made very welcome, and if you could bring that film with you, we will make sure that we've got a venue for it. I can say that with some degree of authority, because we were discussing the May Day event only last night. But I think one of the things that comes out of this, your talk, was to fetch back that old expression about perfidious Albion, the role that Britain has taken over the years, decades, almost centuries now, on this issue of Israel and the liberation of the Palestinian people needs to be tackled in the most vigorous possible way. And what I would like you to possibly end the evening on is what you want to see from us in this room, us in the Sheffield Humanist Society, and us who have any sympathy at all for the Palestinian people, what you want us individually and collectively to do in the campaign to achieve your objectives.
Thank you very much.
It's more of a personal query, actually, that my father was out there in the late 40s. He died a long time ago, so I couldn't ask him this. But he was there when... Was there a King David Hotel blow?
Yes, 1946, what? Yeah.
46?
1946. Yeah. I can tell you about more about it.
Yeah, he was one of the people who he had to dig the bodies out to.
Yeah.
It's affected him for the rest of his life.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it's, as I say, it's got a personal interest.
Yeah. I'll elaborate on that, yeah.
Thank you.
First of all, your point. No, I voiced my anger and frustration at the propaganda that was for decades, you know, directed at the Western world, that the Arabs said to the Palestinians, "Leave your homes, we'll ethnically cleanse the Jews, and you come back." While the actual fact of what happened is that the Zionist militia started the war of ethnic cleansing well before the war broke out, and that's proven in a famous book by a professor called Ilan Pappé, called Ethnic Cleansing of Palestinians. You can Google it and get it. It's
so does the Israelis.
Definitely the Zionist militias. And as I said, I would definitely recommend a book called Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by Professor Ilan Pappé, PAPPE. And it's a book that documents the plans. It was taken from the Hebrew Library in Jerusalem, the University Library, documents of how they planned the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. So, but I was voicing my frustration at the propaganda which we are still facing until now. We didn't do anything. You chose to leave, and even if we believe that, if you chose to leave your house, you can come back to it, for goodness sake. I mean, which was a lie. I haven't left my house by choice. But if I left my house by choice, does this not make it my right to come back? That's the first one. As for religious element, I think I, if you allow me to share, I would like to spend a few minutes on that, because you are quite right. The Palestinian movement was never religious. The Palestinian movement was the pride of the world, because it was calling for liberation of each human being, was calling for democratic. I was brought up in this environment.
Yes.
I thought the people of Britain, if they needed help, I would be with them. The people of Nicaragua, the people... That's how the Palestinians were. That's how they took the admiration of the word. But, and this is not a conspiracy theory, this is documented evidence. Exactly like what happened in Afghanistan, which everybody knows about it, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979, and Zbigniew Brzezinski walked into Carter's Oval Office and said to Mr. President, "This is our chance to give them Vietnam." And then they started training the so-called Mujahideen, so-called Arab Afghans, and they gave them everything, to the extent that rumor had it that Osama bin Laden himself was trained by CIA officers on how to capture a village with three people. That's the rumor. I'm not saying it's true, but it has been mentioned in so many circles. So the same story which happened from the 80s onwards and created that so-called monster that is Islamic fundamentalism, which they created it, and I believe they meant to create it, and now they are happy to destroy it because it all serves their economical and influence interest. The same thing happened in early 70s, this time in Egypt. In Egypt, there was a president called Nasser in the 60s, and Nasser was regarded as this Arab socialist, Arab nationalist,
yes,
the hero of the poor, the hero of the people who are fighting imperialism. He was portrayed as a Hitler in the English, in the British media in the 50s, when he wasn't. He was the hero. 9 million people came out in his funeral after he died. Obviously after he died, what am I saying?
he was demonized.
Yeah, he was demonized. So when the new president was pro-American, took over, and that was one of the mistakes of Nasser. How on earth did he have a deputy who didn't know his intentions? The Americans, and again the same persons, Zbigniew Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger, advised the American administration through two papers. They were both professors in universities, Harvard and somewhere else, advised him that the only way to counter this movement of Arab nationalism, socialism, etc., agree with it or disagree with it, that was what the Arab world was, is to harbor and support and sponsor Islamic forces. And it started in Egypt in early 70s. And with the rise of Islamic influence, or Muslim groups influence in Egypt, it affected the whole area. Now, in mid-70s, Israel followed the same thing. And this is a very controversial point, but I'm gonna mention it. Israel turned a blind eye from the 1975 up to 1987 for the growth of what is called the Muslim Brotherhood movement in the Gaza Strip, mainly, and the West Bank, which evolved to become Hamas. Now, that doesn't mean Hamas is a collaborator with Israel. No, but they used them without them knowing. They turned a blind eye to their growth. They gave them libraries. They gave them licenses to open sports club, clinics, charities, network of welfare organizations, which made them extremely influential among the Palestinians. While they went down on the PLO like a ton of bricks. You cannot open any charity, anything, if you are known to be sympathetic with the PLO. So the map started to change. Then the Iranian Revolution came on board. And with this, the Iran changing from the hands of the American to exporting the Islamic Revolution, the whole map of the area. So whole map of the area changed. It is a sad picture, but it's a picture that unfortunately was created by the interest of the Americans, mainly the Israelis and corrupted Arab regimes in the area. Now they are paying the price, or at least we think they are paying the price for that. But yes, it's a very terrible picture. Yes, it is really distorting the Palestinian cause from a cause for freedom, a cause for fighting injustice, to a cause that is limited to a certain group of people, which I personally am not comfortable with. But again, I have to be honest with my principles and say, regardless of what these people are, they are the oppressed, and that's how I look at it.
Yeah.
I had a lot of disputes with them on social agenda, on every other agenda, but politically they are the oppressed, and they are among the bigger group of the oppressed.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'll take you next.
I don't understand what it is that Britain and America and other European countries got out of colluding with Israel to destroy Palestine. Why is it that happened?
Why?
They still happen.
Well, as I mentioned in the beginning of my talk, it happened initially because the influence of massive figures of the Zionist movement from 1897, even from the 19th century before that, and how much they controlled big financial operations, organizations in Britain and Europe, and how much influence they have in government. You only need to mention the word Lord Rothschild, for instance, to realize how much of a, at that time, one of the massive figures of commerce in Europe, and how what influence he had. And he was a Zionist, and he could influence. So it was really the the collusion came out of the influence of these massive figures in that part, in that time of the start of the conflict. Recently, the Cold War obviously was a main element of why the West has supported Israel, because the Arab world sided with the Soviet Union, because obviously the Soviet Union was against America, and America was Israel, effectively. So the collusion, the West in general, wanted Israel to be powerful and wanted Israel to be the tough policeman in the area to secure their opposition to any influence by the Soviet Union in the area. The Soviet Union was finished, then came oil. So Israel is there to make sure that all these regimes are in order under the line. All what's happening in the area is in line with the American interests. So it's all to do with interests. It's all to do with interests. And if the Arab countries are sincere about the Palestinian cause, the picture will be altered, because they have massive power, but they are, all their regimes are puppets in the hands of the American administration. So, for instance, what's happening in Iraq now, it's a scandal. You know, America's getting all the oil from there, and an Iraqi person buys a container of fuel for his car, that big, according to an Iraqi friend of mine, $100, in a country which floats over oil. They don't have electricity in Baghdad, one of the biggest capitals in the world. They have electricity 6 hours, and then they have it off for 4 hours, and so on and so forth. They don't have it in all the country same time. So to ensure the Western American interest in the area, Israel must be powerful and must prevail. And you gotta put in mind as well the nature of so many leaders in the past in the world. For instance, the notorious, for describing him as notorious, Winston Churchill. He looked on Palestinians as nobodies. He's famously said, and again, I'd like you please to research this, and I hope you prove me wrong, because it's awful. And when he was talking about why Britain must be with the Israelis, he described the Palestinians as dogs. And if dog, those were the words, if dog lives in a manger, that doesn't give him the right to that manger. So that was the racist approach to the way they thought about other nations. Very openly, the Churchill tried the chemical weapons against the Kurds in northern Iraq, just to try the weapons in 1926. You know, he was in favor of doing it, you know. So it's all this, but mainly the interests of the Americans in the area now, and previously the interests of the British at that time.
I'll take another group of three questions before we stop again.
Yeah.
Graham.
I just want to ask you, I'm sorry, I don't really understand, we're in the 2006 elections, I think, when Hamas won, I meant to go over the street. It was 2006 rather than 2007, I can't remember. But I can't.
It was 2007.
2007.
June 2000. Yeah. Oh, sorry, the elections 2006, they took over the Gaza Strip in 2007 by four. Yes. Yeah. Well, January 2006, you're right.
But those elections were both Gaza elections and also West Bank elections, yes, weren't they? And I can't really understand why the Fatah people dominate in the West Bank. But they don't dominate. Well, it seems to me that Hamas should be overall in control of both the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. But it's not like that, is it? So how is it that the Fatah people managed to control the West Bank when they lost the election, which was over both territories, as I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that?
I'll take two more questions just before we answer that. Richard?
Yeah, okay.
If that's okay, just.
Right. You not actually mention the guilt of the West in respect to the events of the Second World War yet, and how the moral high ground is taken by the Israeli state because of that, and how a blind eye is turned again because of those events to what actually is happening. Nobody criticises the Israeli or the Jewish state, again because they are deemed to be anti-Zionist, anti-Israeli, whatever, and the moral high ground has been taken by the Israelis. I mean, the fact that the Berlin Wall Mark II is not criticised to the extent that the Berlin Wall Mark I was and still is, I think tends to sort of, is just an example, you know, of this sort of guilt at this moral high ground.
Matt?
Kind of a response to your question about why America and the West have been so invested in Israel. America wasn't actually that invested in Israel until the revolution in Iran. If you look at the amount of aid to Israel, it spiked massively. It was, you know, a few million dollars, and then it was hundreds of millions, and now billions of dollars in military aid. That was because Iran, under Bashar, had been America's main kind of strongman in the region to keep it under their control. When they lost that, all their eggs were in Israel's basket, and they're fully invested in there now. Another reason, particularly with America, is actually to do with religion, which is Christian Zionism, which is a very influential movement in the US, which is Christians who think that for the second coming of Jesus to occur, all the Jews in the world have to be in Israel, in the historical land of Israel. And actually, many of these people actually, another reason they like Israel is because they're very anti-Semitic themselves and want the Jews out of America and away from them and into Israel so a second coming can occur. Which is yeah, you're looking at me like this is weird, but this is true. It's a hugely influential movement in America.
And they'll be slaughtered in.
So that's one reason, and this is part of the main problem with religion, I think, in here, is actually between the Zionists and the Palestinians. Most of the Zionists are secular. There's a portion who are kind of fanatically religious, but most of them are secular. And again, the Palestinians aren't resisting occupation and ethnic cleansing because the people attacking them happen to be of a different religion. I don't think they'd be any happy about it if the people doing it were Muslims as well. Mm. They're just resisting because they are. But you've got people on the outside, in Iran, in other places, egging on militaristic terrorists on one side, and then you've got Christian Zionists all over the world egging on Israel, sending aid to the settlements deep into the West Bank and so forth. And so you've got religious groups on the outside just worsening the conflict by constantly feeding it. So religion isn't really the cause of this conflict, but it's definitely from the outside making it worse.
Mm-hmm. Don't say those last three.
Yes. First answer to your question, I just would like to point out that Hamas won the elections in the West Bank as well. So their landslide was both. In fact, they won in the West Bank more than in the Gaza Strip. So if you go through every town, like in Nablus, they won 6 out of 8, in Ramallah, 5 out of 5, and Hebron, 8 out of 8. In the Gaza Strip, they won, but not to that level. So, yeah, but how did they control it and control the Gaza Strip, and they couldn't control the West Bank? It's because of the map. I showed you the map earlier. The two areas are separated. Between them, there is Israel. So there is no geographical contiguity. And Hamas kept arming through the Egyptian border and strengthening themselves in Gaza. So the main power is in Gaza, still in Gaza. The popular support is in the West Bank as well, but their main armed wing was in Gaza. That's how they could control it. And Sharon, in his ingenious, before he went into his coma, he decided in a very shrewd move to unilaterally pull out of the Gaza Strip. So in 2005, July 2005, he pulled out of the Gaza Strip. So with the Israelis disappearing from the Gaza Strip to the border, as we say, changing it from a smaller concentration camps to one big concentration camp, the Hamas got much more stronger in the Gaza Strip, and I believe that was the plan by the Israelis to really make Hamas the dominant force, because they wanted to link this with the war on terror and links with Al-Qaeda, etc., which doesn't exist in the Gaza Strip, because Hamas is a movement that is part of a bigger movement called Muslim Brotherhood, which is like enemies of Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda believes you shouldn't have elections, you shouldn't have anything, you shouldn't be part of any of these earthly atheistic regimes. You should fight them non-stop until you are victorious. So there's no link between the two, but the real point how they control the Gaza is the withdrawal of the Israelis, them arming through Egypt, and they didn't control the West Bank because they couldn't reach it. But had there been geographical contiguity, they would have controlled the West Bank as well, because the Palestinians were fed up with Fatah completely and the corruption that happened. And even the armed forces of Fatah, they were not like ideologized to the extent of fighting their own people. But while on the other hand, Hamas, they're very ideological. Like if they fight a Palestinian who's a secularist, they're fighting the atheist. So it's a well worth cause for them to fight. And that's the difference between the two. The number of the Fatah military force in Gaza was 40,000 people, and Hamas was 7,000-8,000. But the 7,000-8,000, all of them fought. Fatah, possibly 200-300 people out of them fought.
But if Hamas is actually very popular in the West Bank, which it is, apparently,
they are very popular.
Got the majority of votes in those elections. How come Abbas, is the president, yeah? Of what? Of the West Bank? Or of the whole of the joint Palestinian...
No, and on paper...
On paper,
Abbas is the president of the Palestinian Authority, West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Practically, he doesn't control anything in the Gaza Strip, so he's president of the West Bank, practically. Yeah. But under Oslo, which brought Hamas to the elections, which is again a hypocritical part of Hamas, because in 1996... openly in the Gaza Strip, and West Bank said whoever took part in the elections is betraying God and the Holy Book. In 2006, they said it's a religious duty for you to go to the elections. So in 10 years, they shifted 180 degrees for power. So under Oslo, Abbas is the president of Hamas, because this government has come under elections for the parliament, the legislative council, which forms the government. And Abbas has been elected under Oslo as the president of the Palestinian people.
So he was elected by the Palestinian
people? Yes, so he was elected in the same elections a year before, elections for the presidency. And then Hamas, so both of them are legitimate, both of them has finished now with their terms. Abbas has finished his term 2 years ago, and Hamas, their term ended in January 2010. So 8 months now they're illegitimate, and Abbas for 2 years is illegitimate. But obviously it's impossible to hold elections now. In the West Bank, Hamas will not have a chance of free election, of fair elections. In the Gaza Strip, Fatah will not have a chance with Hamas control. Back to your point, Matt, about Israel showing interest, America showing interest in Israel in 1979. I would disagree with you. They put more emphasis after 1979, but the interest was there all the time. I mean, the support for Israel was continuous. But after 1979, they lost the other policeman, which was the Shah. And yes, they put more emphasis on Israel and other Arab regimes. But your point about Christian Zionism is extremely right. And the funny thing about it is that the Israelis know that these people are nutters, and they support us for their own agenda, which, as Matt said, all the Jews have to come to Palestine, and they will bow before Jesus when he comes back in the Sea of Galilee, on top of the Sea of Galilee, and 143,000 wouldn't bow down, they would be slaughtered in the valleys of Palestine. So the Jews, the Israelis know that this is why they support us, but they don't care, because they go in thousands and thousands to Palestine. They rally in support of Israel. They know, the Israelis know that that's what they think, but they're using it, very shrewd. There was another point which I wanted to come back before I come to the last point, about the 1946 King David Hotel. That goes in line with what I said when the Zionist militias felt they're very strong. They wanted to attack British interests, British soldiers, British interests, so that the British will leave. And as I said, I believe it was collusion with the government, the British government wasn't like. So a very famous former Israeli prime minister called Menachem Begin and his group was called Ergon. They planted bombs in the King David Hotel in 1946 and they blew it up. 200 people were killed and injured, I think 96 killed and 104 injured. And it was a massive explosion which took the complete face of the hotel and killed tens of people. And yes, it was a massive blow, a massive tragedy for the British forces. And I'm not surprised your dad was traumatized by it, because it was really on a massive scale. But the funny thing is, Menachem Begin was, and still is, in the records of the Scotland Yard and anti-terrorist branch, etc., as a wanted person with this picture. Menachem Begin wanted 1946, blah, 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 blah. But then he was received in Britain as a prime minister, etc. And nobody talks about the same thing with their other prime minister, who's called Ishaq Shamir, who killed a famous British diplomat called Lord Moyne. Again, him and two other activists, out of their principles of fighting for Zionism, they killed the British diplomat. And again, he was wanted. And famously, the Syrian foreign minister, when Ishaq Shamir in the Madrid summit for peace started accusing Syria of being terrorist, he pulled out the picture in a very childish manner. He said, "You took her as a terrorist, what's this?" And it was shown to the world, you know, wanted for terrorist activities, as Ishaq Shamir. The point which you mentioned about the moral ground, yes, I did pass quickly about of the Second World War for a reason. I don't want to fall into the trap of saying that Europe compensated the Jews for the crimes against the Jews in the Holocaust. Because I don't believe so. I believe the plan started well before that. But yes, you are right. That didn't help, because ever since, and it's a very good point, and thank you for bringing it, but the 25 minutes made me run through my talk, because as I said before, it's such a massive issue. I mean, if I wanted to cover what was advertised in the leaflet, I'll be here till tomorrow morning. You know? So it's a very good point. They have got the higher moral ground in front of the European people, and they're still using this anti-Semitic card until now. And strangely enough, they used it against Jews. You know, Jews who support us are anti-Semitic and self-hating Jews, so we cannot win. So I really don't care about this accusation, because I know very well that I'm not anti-Jewish, I'm not anti-Semitic. So if they accuse Jewish people, like Ilan Papeo, who I mentioned, is a self-hating Jew. Jeff Halper, who's another friend, head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition, is a self-hating Jew. Hayu Meir, the Auschwitz survivor, who gave a talk in Sheffield that I wish everybody in the world would listen to. You know, he refused completely when people stood up and said to him, "We sympathize with yourself." He said, "Shut up, don't sympathize with me. If you care about the Holocaust, do something for the Palestinians." That's what somebody who was suffering in Auschwitz. But we cannot win. These people are professional, very professional. I'll give you one story which is extremely impressive. There's a group now which is boycotting the Israeli Medical Association, because the Israeli Medical Association in the last 10 years, and before that, but the last 10 years it was revealed, is colluding with interrogators and torturing Palestinians. And that was a court decision. The Israeli court said that the interrogators can use mild pressure on the detainees to get information, and they appointed doctors to supervise the torture, so that, for instance, if I hit you here, where it doesn't show if I'm brought before the Red Cross, well, if I hit you on the kidneys badly, and I don't understand anatomy, so I say, no, hit him here, there's nothing, we're hitting here, nothing will show, there's a bomb. So in a meeting between this group, Derek Summerfield, the doctor from London, who's heading this group, boycott of Israeli Medical Association, IMA, they sat with the head of ethics, and they were complaining about the torture of Palestinians, and the head of ethics told Derek Summerfield, and he's telling it to everybody when he talks, he said to him, "What's the big deal? What's the two broken Palestinian fingers in return for information that can save Jewish lives. Now, Derek Sommerfeld came back. I'll bring you to the anti-Semitism. Derek Sommerfeld came back to Britain. He wrote to Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi. Outraged. Anybody would be outraged. How can a head of ethics say, what's the two broken fingers? What's the big deal? He wrote to him protesting and saying, this is not on, and we hope you hear your voice against this, blah, blah, blah. And Jonathan Sacks wrote back to him a very polite letter, saying, of course, I disagree with this, I'm going to write to them, blah, blah, blah. At the end, but you must understand the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe, blah, blah, blah. The letter is with Derek Sommerfeld, totally unrelated, but giving him a hint that, you know, we can use the anti-Semitic card. And it's terrible. It's like, it's never, ever. I keep telling this story, and I did mention it in my talk, and I repeat it. Before 1917, we had no trouble. In my own neighborhood in Khan Yunis, I come from the town of Khan Yunis, southern part of the Gaza Strip. And now it's been so traumatized by Israel that a Jewish person cannot set a foot there. I don't think they will set a foot there for years to come because of what my town suffered. But in 1906, a Jewish merchant lived in my street next door to our house, lived for 7 years. And in a famous story, three of my relatives, who were thugs like, wore balaclavas and wanted to, you know, because he's a merchant and he's got a lot of money, wanted to break into his house. And my grandmother was about 35, 40 at the time. She heard the noise and she came out with her massive truncheon. She was a tough lady. And she beat three of them up and she kicked them out and she protected the neighbor. And that's how people were so innocent. They didn't think anything. That he's a Jewish merchant, so what? But after 1917, now the picture was changing, as I mentioned. So yes, the anti-Semitic is a card I would like to warn against, because don't get bothered, because they accused Jewish people of being anti-Semitic. Of being what? What did he say? Oh, it's a famous. There's a famous. We saw a film called Film in the Showroom about Professor Norman Finkelstein, who's a very radical anti-Israeli American Jewish professor. And one of the professors who were asking for his dismissal from the university, he said, he's only Jewish by parenthood. It's in the film. So how can you win? How can you win? You know, he's anti-Semitic, he's only Jewish by parenthood. So how else can he know? What, you know? But they were...
Weren't his parents at Auschwitz?
Sorry, yes, the entire family. Parents, family, all the entire family of Norman Finkelstein were wiped out in Auschwitz. And yet, they are calling him anti-Semitic. So he cannot win. So, I think, but the good positive thing, and I've seen it as an activist, I've been an activist in Shabbat for 19 years now, and I see it gradually. It's a long-term struggle, this will not win it, but gradually I can see the change of people's way of thinking. Gradual, slow, very slow, but gradual. It's happening. Israel now cannot say things that go unchallenged. Even when Palestinians in the past carried out suicide bombing, the world was shaken. But then many people, even that, people started to think, why are these people carrying it out? Which never happened. People were in the past very pro-Israeli. It's changing. And I hope one day it will lead to a better future for the Palestinians.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the point that, you know, you asked why, what, who, why. It's always been oil. From the setting up of the Zionist movement, you know, you mentioned Rothschild, his interest in oil, well known, and oil's always been known to ooze out the ground in Iraq. They used to pave the streets of Baghdad with pitch, 500 years BC, etc. It's always been known, and I think the crucial piece of technology that occurred in history was the internal combustion engine. It was that combination of, there's loads of oil over there and we've got this machine that can potentially mean we can rule the planet with all that energy and these machines, and that's when all hell broke loose. It's always been oil. I mean, and you know, when I see this struggle and this suffering, it just you know, it's what can I say? You know, we're so responsible in this country, the British ruling class, for what's happening in the Middle East. So responsible with their Mackie. But I mean, you know, the British were in Persia in 1870, you know, getting oil, taking over the transport system, and it's just this use of ideology, religion, division between just human beings is so typical of British colonial rule, and it's just been going on for centuries, and I hope that it ends soon.
Gordon next. I've got Gordon and one other speaker, and one other person wanting to ask a question. We're getting, yes, I know, I do. So if I've just finished with those two, unless there is someone else who really has a new question, we're coming up to 9:10, so we'll take it to 9:15. So one more, okay?
Yes.
No, not yet. Gordon next.
Thank you.
You're the third.
About 4 years ago, I was at an interfaith dinner in which the acting, I don't know exactly what the position was, but acting ambassador for Israel was the speaker in Sheffield. And I asked her if the troubles wouldn't have been as difficult if Israel was in fact had a secular government, and I said, wasn't that a possibility? And she said, oh no, a complete impossibility, you know, sort of saying it was for the Jews, etc. And I said at that time, this is one of the causes of the troubles throughout the world, the fact that governments have a particular favour to a particular religion, etc. Then wouldn't it be better if everybody, you know, had a secular government? But it was a no-go, unfortunately.
We did ask.
Sorry, Richard. Okay.
Perhaps if you would like to say something to do with what to do now on the BDS.
Are you going to come back then to
that for something up?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I believe you're an engineer, are you not?
I am.
To see you amongst all those maps, to actually show some impossible objects, just to show the ridiculousness of these people discussing maps, which has gone on since Oslo, and it's not got people any closer to a solution. In other words, you've got some maps which look sort of as though they're very dense, but in fact the area is zero. If you sort of keep dividing a triangle, for example, and eat out little triangles inside, you're ending up with something like Palestinian territories. And I think you should sort of introduce a note of humour in your discourse on the maps, just to show that these discussions are effectively leading nowhere, because the politicians are still thinking in terms of maps for people, rather than, say, water or transport infrastructure or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Would I would just like to sum up now for about 5 minutes? And
yes. I'll sum up with what you asked for, the what we can do. Well, there are limits to what we can do in Britain, but there are so many things that we can do. And basically, our first and main object is to link up with grassroots organizations in Palestine, to make them start to feel that they are not abandoned, that there are some people in those countries which caused their suffering, who are still supporting them. They are knowing it now, but it's good to continue and sustain it. So links with grassroots organizations through campaign groups that exist in Britain is extremely important. That's the first thing we can do, and this is something I will very quickly, if we have time, run you through some of our projects, children projects which we have in the Gaza Strip, and that's something we can link up with. I'll go through it very quickly. It will take me 2-3 minutes, Chair. Yes, we have three children projects, for instance. That's what I'm saying about linking with grass. in Jabalia refugee camp, Nusayrat refugee camp, and Khan Yunis refugee camp and town. So, for instance, in 1999, musical instruments to one of the centers, computers to the center in Jabalia, playground equipment. It's to make mainly we work with children, and that's supporting the ability of children to cope with the trauma they have. So, refurbishment of the of this project ball pool in 2002, we did in one of the centers, and you can see, and I have it actually on video, how ecstatic the children are. These things give like a taste to our political campaign, that we're not only giving rhetoric and slogans, we are linking up with people, and those are NGOs, non-governmental organizations. Massive consignment of toys, not massive, I mean ongoing, with Sunrise and Hope, for instance, in Khan Yunis. You can see the children with basic toys that, again, we buy locally. We used to buy them before the siege, so we support the local economy, obviously all Chinese. but they are like... again, this furniture, this fantastic library is our work from Sheffield in the Sunrise and Center. Another center in the north of the Gaza Strip, similar toys to the Al-Asriya Center. So this is... We provide the equipment for the theater in Jabalia refugee camp. Library project in Nusayrat refugee camp, New Horizons Center. Again, the children with the books which they just received. By the way, I asked permission before I take photos because we don't want them to feel indignified, but they love it. They say no. Again, basic playground equipment, all 2005. Another children's center in Khan Yunis. They asked for all the projects they asked for, we don't impose it. So scout group in Nusayrat refugee camp, they have everything you can see was provided by Sheffield Palestine campaign. The same center, the play area, again the shelves and all the toys and books to the Jabalia summer camp in 2007, the same summer camp we supply everything, you know, the uniform, the equipment needed for work. Another center in Khan Yunis. I'm going through it quickly because of the time, but just to give you an idea of the... and it really works miracles. It really passes a lot of message that people in Britain are supporting you. People are people wherever they are. So it breaks the barrier of race, religion, gender, everything. And that's extremely important. I feel it myself because I coordinate these projects and I see this is... one of our fantastic projects, most fantastic projects, when the Al-Asriya came to the Marilyn Theatre in Sheffield and they toured five cities, we hosted them in Sheffield for 17 days. This is again our very modest mobile library. Basically, we supply the books and toys and they hire a taxi and they put the logos of Sheffield PSC and other charity questions on the trust, and they go around in deprived areas. Children come out and they use the books and toys and then go. That's another place called Kizan and Najjar. This is one of our most fantastic work with Charity Trust. They had a competition called My Best Dream. We sent the competition to Gaza and 72 children took part in it, and they sent these drawings back, these paintings back. So for instance, My Best Dream is to be a teacher, the name of the My Best Dream is to be agricultural engineer, feeling safely. My best dream is to feel safely. Obviously, you can see the AK-47s and the grenades. My best dream to be an interviewer on TV. This is extremely important because it brings the human side of it, you know. So we're not going to solve the political problem. We're not going to solve the political problems, but we can do things on the ground that help people to cope. So again, my best dream is to own a house with a car. Like all of us, you know. So it's something that is being missing from the Palestinian image. I mean, people think of the Palestinians as just fighters and revolutionaries, which is the case, but there is a lot of element. Children are children. To have a better life without closure, this is the sweetest of them all. Become a street cleaner. That's his dream, you know. So to be a dentist. By the way, we have canvases with all these drawings. I should have brought them with me, but they are available. If you visit in the Peace Fair in Sheffield on the 13th of November, we have canvases which are fantastic. You can have it, put it in a frame. My best dream to live in countryside. These are the four children who won the competition. So we arranged for them to to have presents again paid by Charity Trust, which is a charity which we deal with in Halifax, a small charity like us. This is again one of our most important projects, Child Cinema in Jabalia. It takes 50 children inside a room, possibly that big, slightly bigger, but we give all the equipment and you can see the children watching the film. All the equipment were donated by Sheffield PSC. This is again our most recent project, another ball pool in Nusayrat refugee camp. That's the Sabra and Shatila massacre. Anyway, that's what we aim for, end Israeli occupation, free Palestine. And yes, that takes me to the boycott Israeli goods. As well as grassroots things, we need to link up. If you are really keen on the Palestinians, then we should link up with the campaign to boycott Israeli goods. For simple reason, this is our way of supporting resistance peacefully. And we say, no, we're not going to reward the country which is committing war crimes. So that's another thing. There is a good campaign now in every town, especially in Sheffield. We have a good group, the boycott group within Sheffield Palestine campaign, and we do a lot of campaigns at supermarkets in the streets. That's another thing. Campaign which I mentioned about war crimes, that's something. Any ideas you can come out with to strengthen this campaign? But it's really important to bring it to the public, and it's really hurting. I don't want to hurt Israel for no reason, but I want to hurt the criminals who are doing what they are doing. So linking up with this is extremely important. What we can do is simple word of mouth to explain to people what's happening, you know, in Palestine. People, you would be surprised how people are ignorant of what's happening in Palestine. How many people think the Palestinians are equally as aggressors as the Israelis? Campaigning with MPs, campaigning against MPs who are very pro-Israeli. Like, we in Sheffield, we have a notorious MP called Meg Mann, who's like a proud member of Israel, Labour Friends of Israel, and she's campaigning with the church, the Methodist Church, to stop the church divestment, because one of the positive things in the church said, we're not going to deal or invest in future in projects, in certain projects in Israel, but she's working on the church to cancel this. So we need to compare with her. David Blackett is another pro-Israeli MP in Sheffield. Dennis McShane, is he called Dennis or no?
Yes,
who's the actor then? There's an actor. Dennis McShane in Rotherham, he is the one who's trying to bring criticism of Israel, read the law to regard criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic, and he's pushing it in the House of Parliament. So campaigning against these people, with people, peacefully but assertively, is extremely important. And as I said, the first thing is to link up with grassroots to make sure that the Palestinians know that there are people who support their right and respect them more than anything else. Respect them, not only sympathize with them. Palestinian people, despite all the horrors, they're extremely dignified and proud, and they really wouldn't welcome the sympathy without respect, you know, without understanding of their suffering, understanding of what happened to them, understanding of their respect to their resilience and strength, despite them being against all those. But these are the limits. Of course, monitoring of the media as well as something on an individual level. For instance, if you see something and it's misleading, it's wrong, you think it's wrong from your own, just pick up the phone or on the email. The more we write to the BBC, ITV, or the more they will be interested in broadcasting better reports. Actually, I heard this from correspondents in the Gaza and the West Bank. They say when we say anything critical of Israel, 1,000 email lands and 1,000 phone calls with Palestine in the past, only 20 or 30. Now it's increasing, but that's something we need to do. All these things, these are the things which we can do in Britain, and we should really, you know, all of it, we should really be exhausting all of it. But as I said, link with grassroots organizations is extremely important. This is a beautiful picture from children in Sheffield who were at the very beginning of our children's library project. They were collecting, now all of them are 21, 22. But the funny thing is, this boy here, Mishka, we give him the book, and he comes from a family who supports the Palestinians, and the photographer was taking the photo, he said to his mother, "What's that for, mummy?" which made us look like idiots, because the photographer said, "All right, get on with it," but it wasn't really cheating, but he came to Palestine, but it's a funny thing that happened. This is a picture of the Al Asriya folk dance when they came to Shabbat in Orchard Square. A fantastic, fantastic visit. Again, this sort of thing has brought to us supporters that never thought we would see Palestinian boys and girls dancing. So things like this, they are, again, those are, the film is about them, by the way. The film which we are going to launch in the interim is about them. This is part of our activities, our supporters, Concert for Palestine at the Voil. Coffee morning, members' house, basketball we do as well. We do 4 hours non-stop basketball twice a year. 4 hours, and we get about 40 people to play, and everybody puts £10. People sponsor them, so we get £600-700. Falafel Fridays at work, I do Northern Rally, all these sorts of activities. That was Claire Short, by the way. That was Claire Short on the right. Yeah, enough. Yeah. So this is the sort I think if you can link up with these things, that would be great. On the 4th of December, I'd like to invite you. I can't believe I left the leaflets in the car. I can't believe it. I'd like to invite you to our major fundraising event in the Hatfield Institute. I will just rush to the car, bring the leaflets before you leave and come back. But it's our major fundraiser, 4th of December. For these children projects, and we have a band, 4 British musicians led by an Egyptian singer called Ahmed Adnan. They sing fantastic songs in Arabic and English, nice music on oud and cello and drums. So I hope you'll be able to make it, but I'll go to the car if you don't mind 2 minutes and come back when you finish the meeting. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Very quickly, I'd like to thank you very much indeed, Najib, and if everyone else to give some thanks. If you would like to go down to the car and have a couple of announcements, the main announcement is the collection this evening is going to go to the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. So, stick some money in. The next meeting is going to be with Gary Jones from the Optimum Population Trust, us answering the question, does population matter? Matt's been doing our new flyers. He's good. I did the old ones. I'm not. So I think that's wonderful, that one. Is everyone signed up to the email group? If anyone here hasn't signed up to the email group, we have got somewhere, Mike, we haven't got the email list. If anyone hasn't signed up to the email group, if you see me and just leave me your email address, basically we send out an email each month telling you what the next meeting is. We also send out the British Humanist Association and National Secular Society newsletters, plus other odd little bits and pieces which may be of interest. So it's not a sort of, you know, 10 emails a day type of email group. You'll get half a dozen in a month at most. So if you would like to sign up, if you'd just like to come up and just leave your email address with me. So that's the next meeting. We don't have a meeting as such in January, but we will be having our annual non-Christmas meal celebrating the new year. So that will be on January the 13th. If you are interested and you are on the email group, you will find out about it with more information of exactly what we'll be doing. It will be held here, and it's basically a social and a meal, and we will get one of our members hopefully to do a quiz, which some of us can answer some of the questions, but people are obviously can't, not hope and help. Are there any other announcements that people want me to make? Did you want to make one?
Yeah, it's catching tonight. I've left the leaflet at home as well, but Sheffield Skeptics in the Pub meeting on the 15th of November at the showroom, 7:30. We've got a guy, I think they call him, this is all from memory now, I think he's called Mike Cole, he's one of the leading lights in Merseyside Skeptics, who do the 10 to 23 campaign and things like that.
and he's going to talk about, I think, five reasons for not believing in religion and God, something like that.
Yeah.
You'll all be welcome.
And we're hoping that there will be another aside, and we're hoping that there will be a recording of this meeting on Indie Media. We'll have a link from our website, but Richard here has been recording it for Indie Media. Always worth a visit, by the way. Got to plug them. They do us. Thank you very much. And don't forget, there's the tin there rattling away as you go out. Thank you.